Hello and welcome to our program about books, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Kathleen Schock with co-host
Lana Collins.
And during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from the San Antonio Express News and talking about
books, and more books. Well, today we're going to begin with Richard Russo's lovingly clinging to his small town fool series books. This author revisits his familiar cast of characters from an upstate New York in his third novel. The review is by Rob Merrill, who writes for the Associated Press, and the book is titled Somebody's Fool by Richard Russo, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and has 464 pages at a cost of $29. Richard Russo is back with the third book in his Fool series, and while it feels climactic, the author hasn't formally said if it officially ends the trilogy he began in 1993 with first Nobody's Fool and revisited more than two decades later in Everybody's Fool, published in 2016. Somebody's Fool jumps ahead almost 15 years from the end of the second novel. There is an early reference to, quote, the recession the whole damn country is in, unquote, pegging the time frame to the late 2000s. The upstate town of North Bath, New York, has been annexed by its well-to-do neighbor, Schuyler Springs. We're treated to an opening chapter that fast forwards through the lives of a few key characters, and by page 19, the hero of books 1 and 2, Donald Sully Sullivan, is dead. His son, Peter, finds him, quote, sitting on the bench outside studying the racing form, or that's what he'd apparently been doing when his heart quit, unquote. Luck, then, and why some people have it and others don't, endures as a favorite Russo theme. Peter wears the hero's cape in this novel, whose main events take place about a decade after Sully's death. He has inherited both his father's and mother's houses and is fixing up the former in the hopes of selling it for a big profit and leaving town. Fate, of course, has other plans. When one of Peter's estranged sons shows up in North Bath, Peter is forced to consider just how much his life is starting to mirror his father's. Fans of the previous two novels will enjoy reconnecting with familiar characters from Ruth and her daughter Janae and granddaughter Tina, to Doug Raymer, no longer North Bath's police chief, because no more North Bath, and he hopes still his girlfriend, Cherise, now the police chief of Schuyler Springs. Add in Cherise's brother Jerome, back in town after years away in North Carolina, but with the same OCD affliction. And, quote, hapless, unquote, Rub Squeers, just starting to get over the death of his wife, Bootsy, and still not over the loss of his best friend, Sully, plus a dozen or so others, and you've got a sprawling cast indeed. But while Sully is missed as a physical presence in the book, he's never far from anyone's mind. Quote, "Dead wasn't the same as gone," unquote, writes Russo. In fact, a search of the PDF provided by the publisher yields 260 uses of the name Sully in the 458-page novel. Peter, of course, is always thinking about his father, and everyone else is always thinking about the similarities between Peter and his father, or their own memories of Sully. The Fool books nail that small-town vibe where everybody thinks they know everybody else's business, and more importantly, cares about what happens to their neighbors. If it all feels a little quaint in America circa 2023, that's part of the charm, and it's what sets in motion a chunk of the plot when an unidentified body is found hanging in the abandoned hotel. The mystery of the man's identity threads throughout the book, and when the case is finally solved, there's a sense that the tragedy might have been avoidable if neighbors had just known more about the man's circumstances and been able to help. In Russo's world, these characters certainly would have tried. Plenty of them get a measure of life or career satisfaction by the novel's end, guided by one of Sully's endearing rules. Quote, "Do something. If that doesn't work, do something else," unquote. And once more, that book is titled Somebody's Fool by Richard Russo.
Thank you so much, Lana. Well, we're going to review my favorite, which is a historical novel. The title of the review is Through the Eyes of a Seamstress, a touching historical novel looks at life in a quaint Italian village. The title of the book is The Seamstress of Sardinia. It's written by Bianca Pizzorno, published by Harper Perennial, and sells for only $17. Let's go get that.
That's a bargain.
Exactly.
These days.
The review is written by Linda Hitchcock, who is with booktrib.com. The Seamstress of Sardinia, Harper Perennial, is a lovely dream of a book, soothing, pleasant, and welcome in a complicated world often filled with obligations and stress. It is not an inconsequential novel. It chronicles the emancipation and independence of a modest peasant girl into a resilient, self-educated young woman more than capable of thinking for herself, behave accordingly, and act in her own self-interest. The drama of village life, blended with a comedy of manners, is reminiscent of the best of English Regency era novels, as vividly imagined and written with the zest of contemporary works by Adriana Trigiani. Bianca Pizzorno, an accomplished Milanese author, is being introduced to an English-speaking audience for the first time through a deft translation by Bridget Mahler, who is a senior lecturer in Italian studies at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. Pizzorno is a prolific best-selling author of more than 70 adult and children's books, who has sold over 2 million copies in her native Italy. After reading The Seamstress of Sardinia, I hope more of her back catalog will be translated and published here. The setting is a tiny Italian village in Sardinia, the second largest island in the western Mediterranean Sea. It is closer to Corsica, a possession of France, than it is to Italy, and roughly equidistant to North Africa, which are each about 120 miles away. The remoteness of the island community kept it from developing rapidly and helped the society retain its rigid wealth and class-based stratification for longer than in mainland Italy. The story begins at the beginning of the 20th century and continues through the use of an epilogue to some years beyond World War II. The author has chosen not to name the central character who narrates the vivid, engaging, and often humorous stories, beginning with her early childhood memories. She is a Sartina, a little seamstress, self-employed, contracted by day or by job to mend or sew by hand simple everyday items such as bedding, children's attire, school uniforms, undergarments, and less often, women's elaborate clothing. Hand-cranked sewing or foot-pedal-operated treadle machines were available but costly, and thus remained but an inspiration for these humble seamstresses. Depending on the job and the arrangements made, the Sartinas would sew some items at home or work in a client's residence. It was a skilled, respectable trade that provided income as well as independence. In a village where a good reputation was of paramount importance and gossip rife, success was dependent on quality of workmanship, referrals from past customers, and maintenance of a sterling character. Their working hours were long if a commission was large or the deadline short. They would usually be provided a simple lunch, consumed with the servants, and paid in cash upon completion. In this era, there were few department stores where ready-made goods would be sold. The wealthy upper-class women might shop in Turin, Rome, or Milan, or even in Paris for couture items. In this village, there were two dressmakers who had their own shops where they made fashionable attire for the wives and daughters of affluent business owners. The men had clothing made by tailors, as Sartinas only worked with female customers. After World War II and during the succeeding lean years, the seamstresses were kept busy making over, mending, and recycling clients' old clothing. It wasn't long before the economy improved and low-cost factory-manufactured ready-to-wear began to appear in shops and department stores, and the profession of Sartina ended. In the epilogue, our heroine tells the reader she has been persuaded by a grandchild to tell her stories lest they be forgotten, much to the pleasure of the readers of The Seamstress of Sardinia. When she was five, the protagonist and her beloved 52-year-old grandmother, Nana, were the only members of a large, extended family to miraculously survive a cholera epidemic. It would have been easier for Nana to have chosen to place her grandchild in an orphanage run by nuns and gone into domestic service than to continue to work as a seamstress. But she was devoted to this little survivor. From an early age, the child was taught her trade. Nana sewed well and could do intricate embroidery. Her specialty was bedding and curtains, but she also made clothing, including men's shirts, baby clothes, evening wear, and coats and jackets. The little girl watched and helped her when she worked at home and accompanied her to jobs in customers' houses, sitting quietly, observing, and learning. Nona was up before dawn daily to work 2.5 hours scrubbing the entrance and 4 flights of stairs for the landlady in exchange for rent. The child learned that respect, reliability, honesty, and cleanliness were as important to clients as skill. She also quickly absorbed that a family's confidences and secrets were as sacrosanct to a Sortina as confession was to a priest, and it was imprudent to gossip or carry tales. She was little more than a child when her overworked grandmother died suddenly of a heart attack. But she was able to persuade the authorities to allow her to continue to live independently, working as a seamstress. Her charm, gentle demeanor, and eagerness to please gained her friends among the clients. Nona had been illiterate and, wanting more for the child, had arranged for her to learn to read and write. This little seamstress was intelligent, observant, and ambitious. Through her eyes, we learn about the villagers and all aspects of their lives, good and ill. We watch the child grow into a kind-hearted, modest, independent young woman. She consistently honed her sewing and design skills and expanded her customer base after receiving a portable, hand-cranked sewing machine from a former client and now friend. Once introduced to the public library, she continually read and studied subjects that interested her. She loved opera, although she could only occasionally afford the cheapest, uppermost seats, and eventually found time for romance. The seamstress of Sardinia was an absolute joy to read, and I hope will become a favorite selection with book clubs. Pizzorno wrote that while the stories and characters in the novel are fiction, the ideas for the chapters originated from recollections and anecdotes told to her by her grandmother. It was written in memory and honor of 3 women she knew from childhood who were seamstresses, who worked for the family and patiently showed her how to sew, and for her grandmother who taught her many lessons as well. The title of that book is The Seamstress of Sardinia. The author is Bianca Pizzorno.
All right. Well, thank you, Kathleen.
I'm headed to the bookstore.
Yeah, it sounds quite interesting, didn't
it? Yes, indeed.
Well, we continue with a nonfiction entitled Spare by Prince Harry. His memoir is here next with our review by Hillel Italia. She writes for the Associated Press. Prince Harry's Spare sold more than 3.2 million copies worldwide after just 1 week of publication and will likely rank among the best-selling memoirs of all time. Penguin Random House announced that Prince Harry's headline-making memoir sold 1.6 million copies in the U.S. alone. It's a number comparable to first-week sales for blockbusters such as former President Barack Obama's A Promised Land and former
First Lady Michelle Obama's Becoming, which has sold more than 17 million copies since coming out in 2018. The British publisher announced a while back that Spare sold 400,000 copies in the United Kingdom in all formats, hardback, ebook, audio, on its first day. The total sales announced for Spare are for print, audio, and digital editions in the major English language markets, the U.S., U.K., Canada, and Australia. The book has come out in 15 other languages and editions in 10 additional languages are expected. Spare may set records for nonfiction, but no book in memory approaches the pace of the final Harry Potter novel, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which in 2007 sold more than 10 million copies in its first 24 hours. Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, worked on his book with American novelist J.R. Moringer, who also helped write Andre Agassi's acclaimed Open and is the author of The Tender Bar, a memoir adapted by George Clooney into a movie starring Ben Affleck. And so that review of the book by Prince Harry, titled Spare, is published by Penguin Random House.
We switch now to biography. Alice Cooper, at 75, explores shock rocker's legacy. The title of the book, Alice Cooper at 75, by Gary Graff, is published by Motor Books and sells for $64.38. The review is by Kelly Sky Fedorsky, who is with the Orange County Register. Shock rocker Alice Cooper is 75. To celebrate the milestone, veteran music journalist Gary Graff published Alice Cooper at 75, a lush coffee table book full of photos and images exploring 75 key events in Cooper's life and career. The book is an unauthorized illustrated biography that starts with Cooper, born Vincent Damon Furnier, in Detroit, playing in garage rock bands. The book follows a chronological timeline through his 28 studio albums, gory live stage shows, and musical collaborations, as well as his Christian faith, love of golf, charity work, and life as a husband, father, and grandfather. Graff, who has lived in Detroit since 1982 and interviewed Cooper numerous times through his career for various newspaper and magazine articles, described his subject as fascinating. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I was a huge fan of Alice as a kid, he said. Like any other kid, I heard that there was this guy, and he kills chickens on stage, which, of course, wasn't the true story. But yeah, he cuts their heads off, and he wears makeup, and it just captures your imagination. He said that at the time, 1971 to 73, Alice Cooper's music was the ultimate act of rebellion. Your parents didn't like him. Your older siblings didn't like him. And anyone who was a hippie didn't like him, he said. Alice liked to say that they were the stake in the heart of the hippie movement with what they did. So, for a particular generation that was trying to find its own rock icon and its own music, Alice was definitely one of a handful of artists they found, the others being like David Bowie and Elton John. But Alice was doing something that hadn't been done before, and even a lot of rock fans didn't think it should be done. We all said, "Great, then give him to us. We'll take him and he'll be ours." Although he was already a fan and had maintained a friendly relationship with Cooper over the years, Graff said there were a few things that he really enjoyed being reminded of and exploring in depth while writing the book. It was more being reminded of certain aspects of his career, like his association with the Friars Club and all those old-time comedians, he said. It makes sense when you hear Alice tell it, because those guys got him. They understood what he was doing was the 1970s incarnation of vaudeville, so they accepted him quicker than maybe some Jefferson Airplane fans did. He was also reminded of Cooper's connection and relationship with the English rock band Pink Floyd. His friendship with Pink Floyd back in the late 60s is something I had heard touched upon, but then to find out that they lived in the same house and were friendly. Alice talked about having breakfast with Sid Barrett, and what an odd character he was, he said. After I wrote the book, I was talking to Nick Manson from Pink Floyd about something else, but he was remembering the poker games they all would play. He spent nearly 5 months writing the book and several more waiting for the graphics to be added to the finished product. The visuals include full-color photos of Cooper and his band, and there are rare backstage images as well as scanned concert posters from a myriad of tours and various cities, ticket stubs, and other Alice Cooper memorabilia. Graff is pleased with the overall packaging, which is part of a series of books that include Elton John at 75 and David Bowie at 75. I had no idea it was going to have a black velvet cover, so that was a surprise, he said. It's like a backlight poster. You open it up, and it comes with a little envelope of goodies that complement the book. It's a lot of fun. It was one of those things where they weren't showing me each time they found some artwork, but when I got the first PDF of the book and saw what they had, that was a rush, Graff said. He was struck by how embedded Alice Cooper is in pop culture. Cooper had appeared on The Muppet Show in 1978, and he was worshipped by Wayne and Garth in the 1992 feature film Wayne's World. He inspired artists like Marilyn Manson, Rob Zombie, Swedish heavy metal band Avatar, and Swedish rock band Ghost. And he's still rocking. Cooper was out on tour in support of his 2021 album, Detroit Stories, and he still performs with supergroup Hollywood Vampires, featuring Johnny Depp on guitar and Aerosmith's Joe Perry from time to time as well. One of the things that gets eclipsed is that Alice Cooper image and his stage show created great music. He is entrenched in our collective understanding of popular culture. He's created something that will be with us forever. That title again, Alice Cooper at 75 by Gary Graff.
And you have been listening to About Books on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed between 8 and 10 p.m. this evening. This is Lana Collins with co-host
Kathleen Schock
saying
Goodbye
from Owl Radio.